Blog Talk Radio.
About their attacking.
It was under the blood moon. I felt my heart come. I held you in this strange light. A place where shadows.
So basically, I'm looking to tie the entire world to gravitation.
I would like to know how you're feeling right now, given the state of the country, the economy, George Floyd.
Well, honestly, my feelings are not really tied into the economy, but I'm an observer of it. Hopefully, able to take advantage of it, regardless of what direction it may be floating or moving, if at all. But as of late, I have been down. I have to admit, I've been very down. As a matter of fact, for the last 3 weeks, I've gotten almost no work done. Let me explain why. In the news now, particularly in the big metropolitan cities, you have the George Floyd murder. It was an unarmed man. I'll explain it, but I'm pretty sure almost everybody knows or saw what was going on. An unarmed man who was killed by a police officer by having his knee on the man's neck for 8 minutes and change until he died. It set off an unprecedented, backlash and showed significant division in the country. But the division is not nearly as bad as I would have thought it would be. I think anybody who saw it would be devastated and disgusted, hopefully, because it was nasty. Basically, if I would have put my knee on a dog's neck and left it there for 8 minutes until the dog died, people would be disgusted. As a matter of fact, most people would run off and insist I got my knee off the dog's neck or forced it off. But hence, that man died at another man's hands or knee and nobody did it. So essentially, he was treated worse than a dog. I ran into this in detail because that case of police brutality, even though it seemed outrageous, hard to swallow, unprecedented, it's an everyday thing. And it is every day. You can see, I could show you in the inset video of what happened over the last few years. From children to women to, full-grown men, etc. They catch poor people in the ghetto, middle-class people, everybody. As a matter of fact, I got my claim to fame from calling the 2008 crisis.
So far ahead of everybody and so detailed, and then he started warning about Bear Stearns and Lehman. Well, he was so far ahead of the curve, I actually thought he was nuts.
He called the housing crash. He called the collapse of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. He's been harping on the crisis in the Eurozone banking system for years now, so he's just the guy to talk to.
Well, he told us how 0% interest rates were starving the banks that it was designed to save. Now, at the time, you were the only analyst in the world to mention that it would starve the banks, and you've been proven correct.
Reggie Middleton, who nailed Facebook by...
Quick synopsis for those who don't know who I am. I used to be a real estate investor, and I was a dot-com or tech guy. And after selling off my real estate in 2006, because I felt that 2 plus 2 didn't equal 193, I then commenced to short everybody with their business with me. Initially, I was going to create a hedge fund because I wanted access to that 20-to-1 leverage that the hedge funds were getting, because I knew that the banks, the insurers, lenders, the processors, real estate developers, basically everybody involved in the real estate industry were going to go bank. And going to various law firms to create the documents, I was told by a very prominent firm, by the way, but of course I'm never going to name them, that he's never seen anybody like me approach him to create a fund. He says, I wish you luck, but I doubt you're going to get anywhere. I'm like me as in what? He says, like you, a black guy. He didn't say it with malice. It wasn't malevolent. He was actually being honest. And so I wasn't offended by him, but it was off-putting what he said, despite the fact that I have no doubt that it was the truth. But that's just an anecdotal piece of evidence of what black people have to go through. More jarring is the fact that I never did get the hedge fund. I paid $100,000, $75,000, $2007, by the way, $2006 to get the hedge fund started, but never did because that was a bad time to start a hedge fund. But I did create an analytical staff, write reports, and I shorted all these companies with my own capital I got from the real estate investment, and I did very well. We called Bear Stearns months before a collapse, Lehman Brothers, General Growth Properties, which is the second largest commercial REIT, and about 86 other companies. Did a very good job, got a lot of media attention. I was on CNBC. I won their stock draft contest, which is a stock picking contest for professionals. I won it every time they had it. They had it twice. I won it both times. I think they stopped having it after that.
To crown the champion, the winner of the first ever CNBC stock draft.
Yay, Reggie Middleton. Google, which was up by 46%.
Reggie.
Well done, Reggie Middleton. But you know what, Reggie? This is a double amazing feat because last year you won as well.
So, let me tell you the story of racism from my perspective. Okay, racism, discrimination, and prejudice. And this is a tough, touchy subject. A lot of people don't want to hear it, but it's real. And to be absolutely honest, where I thought a lot of people were prejudiced, racist, didn't care, it was honestly ignorance. Not ignorance from a malevolent perspective, ignorance in the actual root word of not knowing. Which is actually much better than me, and I think a lot of other, or than I, and I think a lot of other African Americans would have thought. So, a lot of people that are in the protests that I've seen, I've participated in New York, simply didn't understand what it's like to be a black man in America. So, let me walk you through what the guy that has won all these CNBC contests and that predicted the collapse of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and, you know, big four-digit returns in investment real estate. Let me explain why he almost wasn't here. Growing up, my parents taught me to have full confidence in myself. You know, my father and my mother taught me that I could be anything I wanted to be as long as I tried hard enough. I believed them, okay? And I acted upon that. So I was a good student through grammar school and high school and college. But in high school, I would walk around 42nd Street, which was the red light district when I was a teenager. Right now, it's a big commercial, vibrant commercial area. I would walk up and down the street where all the teenagers would hang out. I had my hand in my pocket. I was 16, I remember. And then I felt something very hard hit me in the back of my head. And they said, freeze or take your hands out. So I did it, and it was a 12-gauge shotgun to the back of my head. Two others came up with guns faced that way. They said, let me see your hand. I said, what is wrong? Shut up. Right? They said, let me see your ID. ID? I'm 16. I have a school ID. Okay? They looked at it and just walked off. That was the Street Crimes Unit in New York, a specialist unit that dealt with allegedly crime, but they harassed young black males. And that was one of maybe six times I've had authorities pull guns on me. Okay? It happened in college, driving around. Okay, the D.C. police, I went to school in D.C., HBCU, Howard University. I was told to get out my car. They wanted to search my car. I said no, with a little bit of law that I knew. He harassed me. I filed a complaint. The complaint went nowhere. Driving back home from D.C. to New York, same thing with the New Jersey State Troopers. Pull you over, search your car, harassment. After graduation, a police officer asked for my phone. This is back when I had the big brick phone. Okay? I was like, why? You know, and he wanted my phone. I didn't realize he was an officer at the time. Apparently to go hit somebody else over the head with, which is perplexing. Okay? I said no. I started walking out, and something just told me to turn around. When I turned around, someone had a gun facing me, fired four shots, okay? One shot went here, through my shirling coat, the other shot went here, one went here, and the other one, right here. I did actually show you what happened. Point blank. Okay? Large caliber bullet. Came in, went in here, and it came out my back. Can you see it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Showing everybody again. A lot of people haven't seen what a close-up large caliber bullet wound looks like.
Yeah. Now you can. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Blood splattered everywhere. Large amount of flesh came out. I wasn't aware of it, but the bystanders said it took me off of my feet, threw me back like 5 or 6 feet. Okay? The police, other police came, called this guy by name, told him to leave. By name. Okay? And I'm like, officer, he says that. He said, shut the, and I'm not going to use the expletive in case my kids hear this, but told me to shut the expletive up with the N-word. See, back when I was a child, they didn't call the N-word, they just said it. Okay? Then, I was lucky enough to be brought to the hospital, which I was chained, handcuffed to the hospital bed. They stuffed the wound, fixed it, and I was sent off to jail and spent the week in the jail. Okay? This was across the street from the NYU Law School in Greenwich Village. It wasn't in the project. I didn't have any weapons. I was a college graduate. Never, you know, had no record, no criminal activity, anything. I then sued the police department. Okay, I was 22 at the time, 22 years old. I didn't know how to vet lawyers properly. I do now, trust me. But 30 years ago, I didn't know how to do it. I lost the lawsuit as a plaintiff. They struck all the black jurors off the jury pool, and the defense ran this story. It was a drug deal gone bad. And they skated. So, that was my life growing up. Okay, that was just 22. Every year or so, there's a significant example of this type of racism. Okay, a lot of people say it's not institutionalized, or some people may say that. It's nonsense. It's pervasive. It's in the police department, but you see what happened to George Floyd is not a police issue. It's an institutional racism issue against African Americans. Okay, over the last 9 months, I feel I was the victim of institutional racism, and it hit me so hard. I took such a significant loss that as part of the end, I can't even comment on it. But the damage done, extreme financial damage, okay? More than tens of millions of dollars. Significant damage in terms of reputation. I pride myself on my reputation. Okay, I'm a good guy for real, and I help others by default. That's how I was brought up. What happened to me did not match what happened to others who were in similar situations. And I can go on. Okay, so when I walk around and I see a police officer, okay, I don't see someone who would come and help me. I see someone who's likely a potential threat. Now that I'm older, I've climbed up the socioeconomic ladder some. I know that I can use political clout, even geopolitical clout on a larger scale, socioeconomic clout, lobbying, donations, etc., to get the police to work for me at a higher level, like they're supposed to. On a lower level, walking down the street, I'm just another one of those guys. Be aware of that. There's an Amy Cooper incident when a woman called the police on a man after warning him that she was going to say I have an African-American man threatening me because she didn't get her way and he was filming her. And she did it. That happened to me about 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago. It's pervasive. So, when you mix all this together, okay, it is depressing. Now, to the positive part, I attended protests out of curiosity. I took my daughter, took my son. Social distance, though, with masks, of course. And what I saw was almost ready to bring tears out of my eyes. Because normally, blacks protest to help blacks. We have a few white people, Asians, etc. These protests, multicultural, multi-ethnic, we had everybody. I'll post the pictures that I took. Everybody in true solidarity, right? 97% of the protests were peaceful, okay? And they're actually helpful. Now, you have all these different races, all these different ethnicities and cultures coming together as one. They got their experience, we've experienced. Heads cracked open, jaws broken, eye orbits crushed, blinded, ribs broken. In jail right now, there's so many people in jail, they can't process them. There's a 24-hour rule in New York City that says that if you stay in jail for 24 hours without being processed, you're allowed to get out. They've broken that rule because the system is so clogged. Okay? And there's still a lot of people in that way over 24 hours. Okay? The majority of those people that I've observed, that I have encountered, are not black. So now, the majority gets to experience what the minority had to experience. And it's eye-opening. So, Reggie, the financial wizard, the guy that was one of the first guys to file blockchain patents for peer-to-peer value transfer, the guy that called Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, the sovereign debt crisis, was the guy that was almost murdered point blank, wears bullet scars every day. Emotional scars, psychological scars. Okay, and visit. You could go on, but I don't want to defame any of the large companies, but you can follow the hint. Now, let's segue from the effects of institutionalized racism to where we are today. Okay, the protests are disturbing, but primarily, or not primarily, but they're particularly disturbing to me because they affect me personally. I have three children, right? Two black sons and a black daughter. And I fear for my sons when they go out. I do. They don't get it, and I didn't get it when I was young, despite the fact I have ample evidence of why my mother should be concerned and my father. But this is happening in a time, the social unrest, social ferment, in terms of CIA and FBI models, which is what we use to measure the social unrest portion of the economic collapse, feeds materially into a significant problem that we have. If you look at my other videos, and like I said, when I called the crash, the real estate crash, the banking crash, etc., I made it very clear, this one is going to be much bigger, much worse, for much longer. Okay? I was predicting that before COVID, because we are coming at the end of a 50-year bond bubble. We're at the end of a almost 10-year U.S. equity market bubble. And a real estate bubble. Basically, an everything bubble, all risky assets. On top of this big bubble-ish bubble, right, with interest rates almost near all-time lows, you also have COVID. This pandemic caused a global shutdown, unprecedented. On top of the COVID, you now have the social unrest and ferment in the U.S. Mix all this together, right, conversations of V-shaped recoveries, absolute nonsense.
Such a struggle trying to climb the ladder of success. Living in a world where every day my strength is put to the test. But I face that test with courage, and I just won't be discouraged. I'm determined, you see, to reach my
possibility.
Now I run across so many things that could block me, but I made up my mind. So much more than I can see, and so much that I can become. That's why I'm reaching for the sun.
I see my possibility. Just woke up and found him here in me. Nothing but green lights ahead of me.
I'm looking
الحمد لله رب العالمين وبسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له ونشهد أن سيدنا محمد عبده ورسوله. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, can you hear me? All right, let me see. I'm good. If somebody says 5x5, that means that you're clicking on all cylinders, okay? This mic's not muted, that mic's not muted. You're hearing me. Now, what am I not hearing? We good. You rock and roll, just like you do. Hey, but in any case, you are more beautiful. Just couple of weeks absent, a little absenteeism. Absent makes the heart grow fonder. All right. Allahu Akbar. I do gotta check something on this system right here. MacBook speakers. And talk to me. Mahas.
Assalamualaikum.
Alaikumassalam. Okay. So I had to flip another switch. Now, what's up, gorgeous? Now I don't have to act like I'm hearing you. Because I really do, right? Hey, let me let everybody know. We're going to be a couple of minutes over, not a lot, but a couple of minutes over the bottom of the hour. The clip is a little bit longer than quote unquote the usual, but it's a clip from in April, and I'll say more about that. Let me say this, okay, just in case, because there's a chance that I could forget it coming up. This brother Reggie Middleton's his website that you can do a deep dive on him, and it's really as much. This was last year. You heard him talking about George Floyd and all the rest of that. So this is that's 421 this year actually when we did that. But his boombustblog.com. Okay, I want to make sure everybody has that in mind. You need to select your favorite, bookmark it, whatever, and spend time with him, because he's like one of those geniuses, one of them George Washington Carver cats. And we're gonna say I'll say stuff more, inshallah, about that. Let's go forward. Just give me two bars or a minute or two on what's up in your world. You tell Daddy, you haven't checked in with Daddy for me
you
to
know,
really drop.
We're in the season of goals, evaluating what happened this year, really shifting mindset about brand and worth, choosing to be like, with most entrepreneurs, this is that time where we choose to decide how uncomfortable are we willing to get in order to gain the comfort that we really want in our wealth journey. And so this has been that time for me, and really evaluating relationships and the kinds of conversations that I have, and valuing the people that are around me, because our body is acclimated to social report cards, so to speak, because of the new year, and you reflect on the gratitude of making it through another year. There's that may not have made it through this year, and being grateful that we have another opportunity to really, start again based on this Gregorian calendar. But this is what we're used to, our society, physical body is used to. Hey, New Year's is January 1st, but, happens every month, So that's what I'm on. I'm so proud of my friends who have evolved and are putting their head down. So it's good. This is really a good time. I'm grateful for the struggles.
Alhamdulillah. Well, there's plenty more where that came from, my dear.
Yeah.
No shortage of that. I'm going to get out the way. You take your time, okay? All right, sweetie. Love you, baby.
Love you too, Baba. Alaykum salam. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمد رسول الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Welcome to our Wednesday and the last Wednesday of year 2001 and I'm about the fact that every time I show up in very specific space, I'm ready, right? And it doesn't feel like a burden when I have taken on responsibilities or a task, right? And it's because I made some shifts and some changes that would allow me to enter a space my fullest authentic self, right? And so this is what this moment is. So like right now I am being in my home because my best friend is preparing her brand new shoot for she's going to enter into the new year and present herself to the marketplace fresh and new. And so she's over here. And so I was like, look, we're not going to stop the show. I have a responsibility to do this. And so I made the shift, right? So our next in this shift of economy. And this shift in economy and moving into this crypto space, this NFT space, is a matter of certain understanding about your financial life. The new concept doesn't negate what you've already been doing. What it does is you are now prepared to make the shift, right? And in your preparation, being able to shift, it's easy because you are in a mindset, right? So crypto, this crypto knowledge and this moving into this crypto space and NFT space and this change in economy to many can feel very daunting. It can push people in a place of feeling, like they've fallen. But the only reason why that happened is because there wasn't a financial plan in place, right? So when you already have a plan, something new pops up, it's like, okay, well, this of my financial life is set. So when something new introduces, it's like we can now build around that, and I won't feel so behind because I'm late on really now how am I creating new streams of income, saving, look, was I even taking part of with a wealth coach? Was I watching documentaries on understanding economy and money? Was I used to creating a budget and what that budget looks like and tracking how I'm spending my money? So if you weren't never doing those things initially, something new entering into it can always like Jenga, right? The game Jenga where you stack the blocks, that you add something new to it or take something away, it can all come falling down because you weren't strategic in the building. So for those that are new to this and never really had a financial strategy, it's not too late to start a financial strategy, right? So I know that my delay in entering into the crypto space was because I didn't really have a financial plan. You know, crypto's been in for at least 10 years now at the minimum, right? And when it first came out, I was so busy focused on, look, I need to get the rent in order. I need to I don't even have a full-on, a real retirement plan. I'm hand-to-mouth with doing hair. And, you know, I wasn't in the mindset of financial planning, what that looks like. I was dreading when it was time to file taxes. Like, that was the life that I was living in early eras of crypto, and everyone was like, just buy it. And I understood this excitement of the just buy it, but my mind was like, there were still some very clear responsibilities that didn't quite, and I'm a one income household, right? There were some clear responsibilities and mindset about money that I had to grow into and have to start to understand and shifting and making this choice and move for myself. But now it's like, okay, I talked to my sister, my sister-in-law, and I had told her, I said, yo, you know, I know that you've been doing, tell me what I have to do, because the NFT speaks my, you know, it piqued my interest because I'm an art person, right? I'm really into, like, you know, people who are into, wealthy people who are like, I buy a Birkin, buy bags, like purses, like that's their big thing. Never been my thing. Like, I'm not a designer purse chick. But send me to an art gallery or to an art auction, Camila is raising her number, like making the bid, right? And knowing that, it's like that is what gave me this desire, this strong interest in understanding it, because at my core, I'm a person of culture. I'm a person about understanding cultural trends. I'm very creative. And so this idea of NFTs, it made the ins and outs and technical parts of it still working through and making sense of that. The base of it being art, I get it. Like, I get it. If there was an opportunity, it's just like similar to the opportunity of you hear a song and you go, oh, this thing about to blow up. Like, this song is about to be used for commercials. It is going to be a TikTok phenomenon or whatever. That NFT gives you that opportunity that when you see something, you can recognize the value potential at the base level, right? And I'm still studying it. I'm still learning it. But to benefit from it, you have to have what they call, which is new to me, a wallet, you know, a crypto wallet. So I was like, bam, okay. So I contacted my sister like, hey, get me up on game. Like, what are you using? How do we get in it? And so I've been watching the videos, and it's exciting. This is what starts to get exciting about wealth building, is the learning process, right? And in the learning, this learning is an opportunity to expand your brain. It's the gym for your brain, as well as for you to visualize the possibilities of what an investment can do for you. In the same way of when you start a business, right? You know, people who open up a retirement account or 401k or whatever it is, they get excited about seeing how much is being put in and, you know, what the business is matching and things like that. And it makes them want to study more, to learn more, to understand more about the investment, right? And so I'm there, right, with that mindset. So let me talk about the making space, something that I cover quite a lot with many of my clients, is how do you make space for the success or the goal that you're seeking to accomplish. So if you're trying to achieve a financial accomplishment or success or a financial goal, there's this moment where it's like, okay, if someone was to give you a $10,000 check tomorrow, do you know what you're going to do with it? And anything that does not have a plan is, you know, they say if you don't have a plan, you don't plan to succeed, you plan to fail, right? And I'm paraphrasing. I don't think that's the word for word, but to know where this money needs to go. So one thing pretty often is I sit and I'll budget out the ideal check. And it's good for the brain because you start to recognize what are the things that you value and how to create an opportunity for it. So I have budgets like all over in my home. I have one for I have a $10,000. I have one for a $5,000. I have one for a $25,000. And this show helps me to see what are the things that I'm prioritizing, right? So today, in the midst of me working this budget out, because I'm thinking about the team that I need that frees me up to do the work that I need to do. And so making space for my success meant that I needed to create a schedule in a way that I can sit down and plan and strategize business looks like, what my financial future looks like. So I shifted my bedtime, and I've mentioned this before. I've shifted my bedtime to get up earlier, and now that Fajr comes in later, I get up at least an hour and 10 minutes before Fajr so that I have that time to myself. And then Fajr is that time that allows me to stop and really start my day. I'll go to the gym and do other things. But I have time now that's uninterrupted to plan and strategize and set the goals that I need to set for myself, to see what works and what's not working, to watch a podcast, read the book, listen to the Audible, all of those different little tools that will be helpful for me. And so sometimes we haven't given ourselves the opportunity to create the space. So you want the $1 million. Okay. If you were to get a $1 million check tomorrow, what are you going to do with that $1 million check? And usually with doing that, there is a magnet. There's a magnet. There is this universal magnet that is like, okay, this person is preparing to be a millionaire. This person is preparing to make a certain amount per month. So I'm focusing on how much I know I need to make per month. What is it that I want to make per month, and being clear about how that's done. And so in the midst of, you know, I play around with those thoughts when I was driving around this morning, and I said to myself, you know, I need to get to this place where I am done. I'm not doing car notes anymore, right? And we hear it all the time, but I come to realize that my car notes will hold me hostage. Because I'm like millionaires, they don't have car notes. They cash out. They buy the car, cash out, right? Or they don't. They have somebody that drives them, right? And so I'm like, okay, I see how that goes, because you're tying up an additional $400 a month of your money that could be, you know, set into investing that can allow you to hire some additional help that frees you up to be more creative, to do the things that you need to do. You know, it's that additional money that will allow you to fly first class. And I'm saying that every time I get an opportunity to talk about first class flying, I said the next time I fly, which most likely will not be this year, I'm putting my wings down, that I said, fly first class. I can't do coach again. And it's a reality. It's a mindset that's just like, yeah, millionaires don't fly coach. They're not cheap in those areas. They're not cheap in areas of comfort. There is a quality of life that you have worked hard for, right? And so I say that to say that made me start to think about how I need to start shifting my money to ensure that I can immediately get rid of this car note to free myself up. So making space for? What is the life that you are, feel that you know you deserve, that you are worthy of having, that your family is worthy of having, that when that charitable ask comes up, you don't even have to think about it? So what does that look like? And are we visualizing it in a healthy way that's not just the daydream, but really being able to put practical, actionable plans in place in order to execute this vision of what you know your life to be and what it's supposed to be and what you deserve? How are you engaging in this life and establishing the community of comfort and abundance and living in a wealthy way of living? Because there are things that you'll have to sacrifice to ensure that that happens. So with that, I believe my time is up. I'm going to ask the imam to come back into the room. You're muted on Blog Talk.
Put all my ears and mouth on again. Okay, we straight. Yeah, alhamdulillah, that's excellent. You know, there's a book, Millionaire Mindset, is something you might want to check into. Millionaire Mindset, because it is all about mindset, right? I mean, that could be a whole separate, that will be and is a whole separate subject too. But you reminded me of something that there's a very short piece online. I'll have to send it to you. A very short piece on Shaq, how Shaq learned how to have that millionaire mindset. He said he told the difference between being rich and the difference between being wealthy is that the person right. Exampled it for him or illustrated it for him by taking a piece of paper and then tearing the paper in half, and he said that the difference between poor people and rich people is that rich people will take what they have as income. I don't have a sheet that I want to tear right in front of me. they would tear it in half, and he said they would save or invest the other half and live on half. They just live on half. Whatever living I got to do, I got to do it on this right here. I just got to work it out, right? Get creative, you know what I'm saying? And then put the other side, save or invest, right? He said, now that's the difference between poor people and rich people. The difference between rich people and wealthy people is that wealthy people would tear the half in half, and then they live on that half and save and invest the rest of it, right? So now if you got that kind of discipline, that kind of grit, that kind of capability, yeah, you could do it on that side. Now, of course, if you got something that you can, what we call DCA into, dollar cost average into, just on a regular, just as an example, I've said this before, I'll say it here also, is that I went back and I looked at all those subscriptions that I have, monthly subscriptions of stuff that I'm paying for, whatever, that I'm not using, right? First on the list was the gym. The point is, it's like, man, but then, okay, add those up and then take that and invest that in something else. And your car note move, that's the move. I mean, if you can get that done, then that is the move. Because that the same way that you that money was moving on out for that purpose, you hold that and then take it, don't touch it, and do something else with it. Now you take that and now make it work like that. All right? And you know, I don't want to put all my business in the street is the least amount, but I'm just the subscription scenario. Put me in a position to do $400 a month for in crypto, right? Just like,
I love it.
I don't think about it. That same money I wasn't thinking about, I ain't thinking about it now. You know, it's just like, boom,
right,
let's go. And that's it. And so you and I, of course, you know, we play cash flow. That cash flow, playing that game cash flow, it will make you will feel that trust. His brain doesn't know the difference between reality and quote-unquote fantasy. Brain don't know the difference. When you play that game, you really are getting those $300,000 out of the rat race paydays, right? Your serotonin and your neurochemicals, the positive dopamine and all that. Oh, man, look what I got. Woo, look at this stock. Look at that. So I'm telling you, people got to get on you. So you have to work with your system. This is what you said. I'm just reiterating it. You have to work with your system, right? And I'm going to get to your piece about what you were saying about art, because that applies all the way around to what everybody got a thing, right, that you have an appetite for, right? Now you just have to translate it into, negotiable bonds, let's put it that way.
Right.
You know, how does that translate into material progress, material success? We're going to get to that right now. So let me go ahead and get down with my piece, inshallah. Okay? Here we go.
Okay.
Bismillah. So to speak of what do I want to do? Yeah, I want to share this with you. Okay. let's make sure everything. Oh no, that's not the one I want to share. Okay. So you have on the screen. I'm opening up with this screen because I'm talking about Web 3.0. I'm talking about several things. So you just slot those things in where you like. But conceptually, I want to start us out so we can have things in perspective. Conceptually, I think most of the people on this line and on this broadcast are aware of Alvin Toffler, right? Alvin Toffler was the famous for the third wave, power shift, future shock. Those that's a trilogy of books each of which describing the flow and the changes in the economy. And so I asked myself in preparing for today, I said, okay, well, when was the third wave first published? And as you see there on the screen, the third wave was first published in 1980. That's the third wave. But the one that came before that, that introduced him to, by and large, to the broader community, was Future Shock. Future Shock. So it went like this: Future Shock he published in 1970. The third wave he published in 1980, and in 1990 he published Power Shift. Those are three big key publications in this order. The one that most people are more familiar with is the issue of the three waves, right? Agricultural, industrial, and information. Agricultural, industrial, and information. So that's the waves that have gone on. Now, we are at this time the language for the state of interconnectivity. I'll use that language. The state of connectivity is we are in Web 3.0. So the movement from agriculture, industrial to information. All right, now information has been slotted off or sliced up into three phases itself. Web one was that you can see in the illustration there. It was a one way thing. You go to your computer and you get information, you read information, you absorb information. And the icons of those early platforms like Yahoo and Netscape and Internet Explorer and the like, I know Yahoo is around. I don't know if the other two are around. If they are around, they're not even so much mentioned anymore. But they were the early platforms, the early utilities when the web in the 90s came out. Then it moved, so this is all inside the information age. Then it moved to Web 2. Web 2 is identified as the platform economy, right? The first one, information economy, but this is the beginning of the splitting off from or inside the information age with this particular technology, i.e. the web, right, which was a new thing, the web. Do you know about the web? What is the web? Okay, there was a time when that was new, and that was Web 1, and these were the types of things that were done on it as a part of the burgeoning or the growing, evolving new economy, which is information-based. But information is just the basic beginning of it. Now it moves over to these platform-type economies, which in Web 2 you would include the Facebooks, the YouTubes, the WordPress, and the like as representative of what was going on there. There were many other activities. I can think about MySpace and other things like that were coming in, but these iconically represent the move into Web 2, still inside of the third wave of the transformations, still inside the internet, the web, et cetera, but with a new focus, with new players, with new possibilities, and it became more of a two-way type of thing. And I think also mobility was the key. You see the cell phone imagery there. You see in fact, Web 1, yes, that's one of the things about those icons there on the left, are desktops. So the idea of this at-home computing, desktop computing, of course, desktop publishing, all that began to come about and through that. And now in this next phase, then you got this this interactive kind of thing where Facebook and YouTube and blogs, you know, which are web logs. That's short for web logs. So people started having online journals and all the rest of the thing that goes with that. And that was all new. So the way that the presenters here from the book Token Economy are identified, first it was just a read information economy. And now we have a read and write information economy in Web 2 with those players that we know about, the iconically represented here. But then also now we've come into Web 3. This is the token economy. The token economy. Token is the thing, right? So it's just like when we first began to use the net as a language, the web as language, all right? Now information was early platforms. We started using language platforms. Now we're at a place where we're using the language token in Web3, token, right? And that token economy, so now you're beginning to talk about quote-unquote money, you're talking about finance, you're talking about exchange of values, and that's where we're going to drill down further on that. It's just for us first to understand this is a part of the evolution inside of the evolution or the continuing evolution upon the evolution of technology. This is where it's going, and it's not going backwards. It's not going backwards. It's very important. And as technology advances, also it advances faster as well. It advances faster as well. So we're at Web3. So you see the icons of this token economy, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then the whole idea about the trading, statistics, economy, and the like, that symbolism. Now, what has happened with this is this, that the dominant players in each sphere have arisen. So the alpha predators. I shouldn't say predators, maybe. Either way, the giants, the survivors, the ones who, you know, who basically gobbled up the competition, relatively speaking, such that they have become the definition of each one of these various phases, right? And who are dominant quote-unquote players right now in the other games that are evolving. And so they're the ones that are, in so many ways, very equipped to take advantage of this continued evolution. And also they're pushing it. And there's a conversation that I can't really drive right now, but there is, you know, some battle of the titans in their attitudes about what's really possible for as far as the metaverse, for as far as crypto and NFTs and all of that. And it harkens back to what we talked about in Ravi Bhatra's Great Depression of 1990. That's really worth reading or being familiar with. In some places, on some of these platforms, you can find summaries of, you know, summary of Great Depression of 1990. Because when you understand that, you also understand, you know, what really happens cyclically in it. Okay, and so there's a spiraling of the transformation of the economy. It spirals up, but you pass some of the same things on the way up. And so the more you understand about the nature of the pattern, then the better you're able to situate yourself to take advantage of the way things are going. Well, that's what we're trying to put you on right now and be on ourselves. But in any case, for as far as Web 1 is concerned, let's just count it off for the purpose of instruction. Like Google, let's call it, won that battle. It's like, you know, where's Google compared to Yahoo, compared to Netscape, compared to Internet Explorer? It's like, okay, Google is in charge. Okay, let G stand for giant, right? So then you got all the AI and all the other things that go with that. And then some of you know, I didn't make note of it, but Google owns some of these other things. I think they, I don't know what it is, maybe it's YouTube. Some of them own others, right? I think, I'm guessing on it. So if y'all know, put it in the chat, whatever. Google owns either Instagram or YouTube or what have you, or maybe it's Facebook. Facebook, it basically is dominant right now in terms of the Web 2. That is the battle of those that sought to try to gain supremacy and gain hegemony, gain major influence, gain major market share in Web 2. So like Facebook is to that phase what Google is on the information side of it. And so much so, you know, they changed the name. We've talked about or why that works. It serves many other purposes. But they're trying to brand themselves. If you want to talk metaverse, then you need to talk Meta. We are Meta. And many years ago, relatively speaking, they invested billions and continue to invest multi-billions per year into augmented reality, virtual reality. They're about being ahead of the game and being right there as things evolve. You know, they want to be in charge. So that's the way it's played. If you are working to try to be, quote unquote, the king of the hill, as these juggernauts that we're talking about are, that's the game they play. You don't have to play that game. In fact, you can't really play that game right now because you have to be really, really big. I've seen a piece where the guy who does it's the British guy that was doing the vacuum cleaner. Starts with a, I believe it starts with a D. I can't think of it right now, but he was also working on doing an electric car. And he spent billions to try to get a share of the electric car market. Didn't keep up, couldn't compete. He was just throwing money into an empty hole. So as big as he was, he was unable to compete there. So even in all this conversation that we're having, I'm speaking to you because of the fact that our objective is to get the advantage of the nature of the broad change and influence and the opportunity that's available to everyone, even as a result of the spinoff possibilities. Collateral opportunities, I'll call it. The collateral opportunities that are there, okay, they're big, but all you got to do is, like, even if you just follow behind the truck, you know, it's like there's stuff falling off of this truck that's going to be real valuable to you. It just depends on how you want to play it. I'm using that only as a description. I mean, you're a genuine, dignified investor when you decide to be a part of it. But metaphorically speaking, I want you to understand that we're not in a position yet to be the drivers, but at the same time, for as far as where we have been and what the possibilities have been for us before, this is a massive, massive opportunity. And so now in the token economy, of course, Bitcoin is the big daddy of them all. Bitcoin is the big daddy of them all in terms of that. So how did this happen, and what does that say about the coming, quote-unquote, future in this new Web 3.0 economy? Because as all the other prior Web 1.0, Web 2.0 has evolved, here comes Web 3.0. The idea is, where are you going to be in relationship to that? There's still gains to be made, obviously, in the Web 2.0, but in terms of the future possibilities, in terms of getting to it early. Those of you who remember on this platform, the early conversation about Bitcoin, what you did do, what you didn't do, and here we are at the future from that time that we began speaking to it. Here we are in that future, and we're looking at a Bitcoin that's right now just $50,000, okay, along with all the other things that are going on. And again, you know, you got to ask yourself, are you on that woulda, coulda, shoulda mode? It's like, okay, but either way, I still want to emphasize to you that, you know, it's never too early, it's never too late for as far as Bitcoin is concerned. Not financial advice, just letting you know what has worked, what has proven to work for the big and the small who get a share of it. Okay, so the Web 2.0 giants are those Google, Facebook, Amazon, even Microsoft. Like Microsoft, you recognize that Microsoft jumped in the whole information age space very early, and you know, it's that's money that's going to be around for a very long time, just like the Rockefeller and the J.P. Morgan money and all the rest of those, because they were the titans and the tycoons of the earlier period, the railroads, the oil, the finance. There was a time when whoever, J.P. Morgan could be the Google of his time or the Facebook of his time or the Amazon, the Jeff Bezos of his time. Okay, so in each era, a group of early adopters, a group of innovators, a group of those who are able to, play the game, if you will, and compete, then they create intergenerational wealth. And that's it. You have to get to the point where you have this selective advantage that goes along with being early to it and being the true nature of, quote-unquote, the game. Now, you all have been listening to me. You know, I'm not talking street when I say the game. I'm talking about, unconscious, incompetent, blah, blah, blah. Oh, that's what I'm saying. And those people who learn that and play that and do that well in their domain, they are the ones that wind up being the giants in their domain. So, and how does it happen? It happens on what is called the network effect. You need to study this. We talked about it. Metcalfe's law. It's the network effect, right? So the network effect is it has to do with the number of people who are using a particular type of technology. When they use that technology, the more people that use that technology, the stronger that technology becomes. And when the more people utilize whatever it might be, the more people are a part of something, then the stronger that they are a part of becomes. Okay, since Amazon was focused on merchandising, the more people adopted Amazon as a marketing platform, the more Amazon disrupted the bricks and mortar merchandising, right? We talk about how Walmart ate the small mom and pop shops. Well, Amazon turned around and ate Walmart, okay? And that's because more and more Amazon became the dominant network effect, the dominant network for merchandising. And so therefore, fundamentally, Amazon is the merchandising mammoth, for lack of a better term. Mammoths are extinct, but it's the big one, right? In that, Google is the same in terms of the dominant network effect as it relates to information, as it relates to search engines, right? Like we talked about, the Yahoos, we talked about the Netscape, we talked about the Internet Explorer, these early search engines. But basically, it's only Google. That's what people say. Google it. Just like it was with Xerox machines, right? Give me a Xerox copy of that. You may be using a Canon or Mitsubishi or a Toshiba copier, but you say, give me a Xerox copy, because Xerox became the definition for duplication, right? All right, well, Google is the network, the dominant network for information, right? So it disrupted literally disrupted the book industry, encyclopedias, libraries, as it relates to sources of information, right? And so it was by virtue of the dominant effect. The more people used it, the greater and stronger the effect, the greater and stronger the network, and in consequence, the more and more Google rose to supremacy in that field. Facebook is the dominant effect for social networking, the thing that family albums used to do, the thing that cameras, quote unquote, used to do, photo albums and the like for interacting, socializing, and all those kinds of things. The social networking, Facebook owned that. Facebook was really new to the game. It's like a wheel or a fire or a wheelbarrow. That's how new it was, that's how unique it was, that's how significant it was, and who can, in that relationship, compete with Facebook, right, who is now Meta, right? So it disrupted the whole face-to-face PR thing. It disrupted marketing. It disrupted photo albums. It disrupted phone calls, all of that. Facebook did that, and so Facebook has that power. All of this now, mind you, this is Web 2.0. Think about the things that we're talking about. One, we've talked about merchandising. The other, we've talked about search engines. The third one here, Facebook, we're talking about social networking. Listen, we haven't talked about finance. We haven't talked about econ. Each one of those are significant from an economic point of view, but that's not their thing. Amazon is not about finances. Google is not about finances and economy. Facebook is not about finances and economy. It's about what they are about. Again, merchandising or search engines, information or social networking. Here comes Web 3.0. Web 3.0 is about finance, economy, excuse me, money. That's the new sun rising. It's still new, even though I was listening to African American in an article that they were talking about how much Bilalians are actually pushing the crypto economy. And one of the things that he talked about when he got into NFTs and getting engaged with NFTs, he talked about 2014 like it was antique or classic or something. NFTs. He said, I got NFT from so-and-so, and it's one of the classics, like antiques from 2014, you know, 7 years ago. Excuse me. So that's how far along NFTs are. And in that conversation, you know, the dollar figures that they were applying to that, it's like, man, this thing has evolved, you know, quite a bit. So the point is that, you know, you got to pick up the pace in terms of getting involved with it. But now, Web 3.0 is largely blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency. That is what's bringing about the dominant network effect for monetary energy. This is the language that Michael Saylor introduced, used, and applied. So it's about money, blockchain. Listen, Amazon merchandising, Google information, Facebook social networking, blockchain, money. Okay, So the whole transformation of economy globally, finance globally, is 2008 when the crash came and when the white paper for Satoshi was released, that was like the big bang of Web 3.0. A whole new world, literally, a whole new universe. A whole new ecosystem as it relates to money. Money is not the same, has not been the same since even that time. It's like the first time we heard and saw that bailout thing, that what? That's like, that was a totally brand new thing, right? Oh, and you know, but see, we missed the fact that something like that had happened earlier. Finally, this thing is called the $1 trillion bet. The $1 trillion bet. That was a time when the total global financial system was on the brink of total collapse. It really happened. Just look it up. The $1 trillion bet. Okay, but let's move on. So all these things, the dominant network effect for all these other three, the merchandising, the information, and social networking, now it's evolving for finances, for wealth, for money, for value exchange. That's where we are right now. It's disrupting gold, fiat cap currency. That means government money, real estate, securities. And when we speak of Bitcoin, particularly as a store of value, Bitcoin as a store and as exchange of value is it has the qualities and the attributes of gold as they operate or as it operates and functions in the economic system. So the point is that blockchain, which is the underlying technology that made Bitcoin possible, that underlying technology is garnering a greater network effect when it comes to monetary energy, just like Facebook and social networking, Google and information and search engines, and Amazon in merchandising. This is where the money of the future is, it present and the future is headed. That gravity, the gravity of where value is going, it's going to blockchain and cryptocurrency, and it's taking different manifest forms. Let's move on. It's draws upon us. I want you to look at this picture right here. Look at this picture. And one of the things that stands out about this picture is, like, for those of you on Blog Talk and maybe not be seeing the image, it's a nightscape of one of our major metropolises. I don't even know which city it could be. You know, it could be New York, but it looked kind of a little more newer than a New York city. But either way, the point is that it's just covered with tall buildings, skyscrapers at night, and the lights are on, right? Just lit up, right? Of course, absolutely every light in every window of every building is not lit, but it has that real jewelish kind of presentation, right? And when I saw this, I mean, this is one of the ways that he said we need to really illustrate what the potential of what we're talking about that's being addressed right now. So in finance, they have what's called addressable markets. The addressable market. When they say addressable market, I mean how many people want whatever that is, right? The addressable market. How many people have the problem that you're trying to solve? That's your addressable market, right? So I asked the question, the addressable market, how many types of light bulbs? Now, you're looking at the picture, and this is a small cross-section of some major city in one state somewhere, probably in the United States, I'll say. It's like that little rectangular section, it's like how much of the world's buildings and light bulbs, et cetera, do you actually think that is? You know, it's extremely small portion of it, but look at how much it is. So the question is, how many types of light bulbs and light fixtures are in use in these buildings? When you look at how many, I mean, it's like beyond counting, really. You know, it's like, yeah, it's just too many to worry about counting, right? That's only one small section, right? So when you talk about the addressable market for light bulbs and light fixtures, how much do you think is actually being represented? It's a lot. And you're only talking about light bulbs and light fixtures. You're not talking about anything else that's going on in the building. You're not talking about anything else that the building is constructed of. You're not talking about anything other than light bulbs and light fixtures, right? So that's the addressable market. That speaks to the addressable market of light bulbs and light fixtures, just that, right? So you think somebody is making billions and trillions of dollars off light bulbs and light fixtures? Do you think that there's room in the market for somebody who wants to get a share of it? Yeah. So when you talk about market share, right, market share, think about this. How much would one-tenth of 1% of the light bulb market be? One-tenth of 1% of the light bulb market. You think somebody can get wealthy, to put it lightly, with just one-tenth of 1% of the light bulb? That's a lot. One-tenth of 1% is a lot. If somebody can say we have one-tenth of 1% of light bulb, you're talking about somebody that is, how can you say, extremely wealthy. Let's do it like that. So my brother, Reggie Middleton, which inshallah I said we're going to go over a little bit today, but I want to get to because he started out with this, with this piece. He was early, and there, in a manner of speaking, he suffered a crucifixion, a deep persecution that was resolved. We'll get to that, inshallah. But I'll stick with the addressable market aspect of it. This right here, we talk about loans, you talk about trades, you talk about contracts, and then trade, you're talking about bond market, stock market, forex, et cetera. These are just some small features of finance. Loans are part of finance. Trading is a part of finance in the bond market, the stock market, the forex market, right? Contracts with lawyers is a part of the financial market. So all this represents the addressable financial market in one, two or three of these small categories, but basically this kind of financing, this area of financing. So for as far as bank loans, the addressable market in terms of loans, around figures $3.2 trillion, and this sounds like it may actually be just in our in the United States, $3.2 trillion, right? In trading and the bond market, $157 trillion. Stock market, $57 trillion. Forex market, daily, $4 trillion, round figures. And then for as far as contracts that are done with lawyers, right, as a means of transaction and doing these, some of these deals that we're talking about here in this class of markets, difficult to quantify. However, this cryptocurrency and what he started out with, and this, I'm satisfied, this is what really got him, quote unquote, I'm saying, in trouble, because it's like scared them to death, basically. And that is that he's talking about disintermediation. So he was wrecking the game for all of these, and actually he has it. Let me move on to the next matter so you can see the depths of it. So when we talk about addressable market, all of that is addressable market for what he has now the intellectual patent for. He has the patent for it. We'll give the detail. But I want you to see and appreciate just in one slice of economy in this Web 3.0, which is the internet of value, right? Exchange of value. That's just a part of the addressable market there. What do you got? 160, 217, and then on a daily basis, 4 trillion. So it's like 217 trillion. He has the patent for what addresses that total market, a problem that's inside of all of those markets, and it is the problem of centralization and intermediation, which is what gave us the problem of 2008, because the third party that was supposed to, that we were told to and dependent upon to trust their valuations, they were lying and stealing and creating false products, derivatives, et cetera, and selling them unawares to, that is, to those who were unaware of the toxicity in what they were, all because of the system that was designed to approve and affirm and appraise these assets. They were lying about it, and people were depending on those lies until the jig was up and everything was near total collapse. That was when the white paper and ultimately Bitcoin, very shortly after the release of that white paper, came into being. Now, here's the thing, that the Reggie Middleton piece of what I'm saying. You got to check this brother out. Listen, go to boombusblog.com and get some good helpings of this brother. You need to know, because it's critical. Let's move on. See, now, imagine someone being able to deal with these financial markets and all of its possibilities without the shenanigans of the caste system, because he got hit by the caste system piece of it because, you know, no ninja, and I'm going to be nice, no ninja is supposed to have this kind of power. No ninja is supposed to. See, he was early in the game. He was early in the game. He had figured out before. Let me just stick with my notes here. So Veritasium was the coin. Ultra coin was the coin that he was proposing before that. And you heard at the beginning of the broadcast when we played his clip, he was on the MSNBC, the CNBC, and all the other, the financial plays. He was winning annual awards from contests that they would have. He predicted when nobody else was predicting the fall of Bear Stearns, et cetera. He shorted some 86 companies himself before no movie was made about him. Nobody was paying attention to him. People were thinking he was crazy. But he got his money on that. Okay, but then he's ahead of the curve for as far as cryptocurrency, blockchain, et cetera. And then he saw the way by which you could apply the same kind of knowledge that he had in as an analyst and as someone who has foresight and insight into financial industries and markets. And he said, well, this Bitcoin or the white paper, which was with Bitcoin, the white paper facilitated the way whereby he could take what he saw and digitize it, make it an app, et cetera, solve problems that are inherent, which were clearly manifest in the 2008 crash. He said, look, I got the solution, UltraCoin, woo, woo, woo. So I'm going to say right now, it's all natural, but I have to say, in hindsight, you think that it's a mistake because you kind of like, you're telling the dude that I got what would make you obsolete. Oh, man. So it's like that's really what happened. So what happened, the Veritasium founder, this is just a headline, he was the founder of Veritasium, which is the actual coin after his speech about, his talk about, his introducing the idea of the Ultra Coin, which I don't know if Ultra Coin exists. I don't think it ever came into existence, but it was the prototype of it, and even if I'm wrong, it was the prototype of what he was saying. But Veritasium, it exists right now, and I saw one clip where at the point that he was having a problem, they took like $9 million. Here it is right here. He agrees to a $9.5 million payment and permanent digital asset bar. It's almost like saying you can't go near a computer and you can't be involved with any digital crypto right there, but that's another story. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that part. The bigger thing is the patent that he has. So in 2019, after 7 years of the SEC coming at him, they settled $9.5 million, et cetera. Okay, that was 2019. So here, just this month, December 9th, 2021, the United States joins Japan in granting Reggie Middleton the most significant asset in the blockchain industry, the Aboriginal DeFi pattern. I know this is kind of opened up more than we have time of it that we'll take right now, but let me take you back to something. I'll show you this. So you have this Google search picture on the page that we're on now. I want to take you back to the first Google search picture. So I did a Google search for the third wave Toffler publication, right? So you got 100 in 0.75 seconds, you got a return of 156,000 results. All right. This thing that happened with Reggie Middleton as it relates to getting an Aboriginal DeFi patent, it might not say anything to you right now, but what it's like the internal combustion engine has just been patented, right? Or whatever, the wheel has just been patented. I am that serious about it. Okay, so I put in the search for him, Reggie Middleton, patent granted Japan. Patent granted Japan. Naba. He wrote this article, and it's on his blog, and another, in one other place called The Block, but doesn't matter. The point is, that happened, and there's not a thing on Google about it. This is no small thing. I'm cutting myself off because it's not, you know, I don't want to go too far. But I knew I intended to take, you know, a little extra time, but I don't want to go super over. But here's the deal. If you haven't seen this movie, you need to see this movie because the movie is Something the Lord Made. It stars Alan Rickman and Mos Def. You need to see it because this is what's going down in this piece right here in relative terms, right? And that is the storyline for Something the Lord Made is that Mos Def's character, his name is Vivian something, sorry, real life, who was an expert at surgery and medical techniques and the like, but it was in a time and a place of ultimate racism. So there were techniques and things that he was able to do that he brought to bear, but because it was not right for a black man to be able to have that kind of credit and to have that kind of access, I mean, credit in the medical field, et cetera, it's like, so this guy, the guy that he, quote unquote, worked with, the industry never credited him with what he was capable of doing, but what he was doing is just literally like miraculous, right? All right, in a similar way, this DeFi intellectual property patent filed for, Reggie Middleton, he filed for that patent, date on the patent, United States Patent and Trademark Office patent filing May 9th, 2014. And everything that Ethereum, and when you see ERC20 tokens and things like that, that means that it's built on Ethereum. But what is Ethereum based on? Ethereum is built on the technology that he, Reggie Middleton, has the patent for. Big A, BlockFi, and most, practically almost all of them. It's like all the light bulbs I showed you in that skyline right there, and you were the guy that invented the light bulb, but you're not getting any credit for the light bulb, but people are still using the light bulb. And the critical thing for his position here is that he's granted the aboriginal, the aboriginal. What that means is this is a backdated patent. The patent goes back to we are the first. Mine is the first. And anybody who uses it and does not appropriately remunerate the owner of the patent, they are guilty of patent infringement. And that means everybody that is using the technology that makes that kind of safe, what do you call them, smart contracts and all that, that's your brother. Your brother has created that and now has a patent from or in Japan, the third largest economy in the world, and America, the first largest economy in the world right now. All right, so the point is that we don't have time right now today to go into the detail, but the point is everything. I won't go any further. We'll get to that because the idea is that I want us to simply understand that what's happening. Let me clear this. What's happening with that is that come on back, Camila. What's happening with that is that we are now in a position where the whole idea of addressable markets is like, man, it's just too much. It's just, that's a lot that I don't even know what to say. I'm at a loss for words. Let me get my brother in here. Fahmi, assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum assalam, as always. Enjoying the program. And I just had a quick comment. You were talking about search engines. Have you seen that meme saying I was today years old when I found this out? I don't know if you've ever seen those memes to say they just learned something today.
I have.
So yes, I was today years old when I found out about the search engine Google Scholar. And I don't know if our class knows about it, but just for example, when you're talking about vacuum, electric, car market, I typed those four words in Google, and it took me about 8 entries before I found Dyson under Google.
It was a very second entry
in Google Scholar. So this is just for the class, for people that are, you know, students like myself and yourself and everyone else. Google Scholar seems to be the way to go. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you. So I'm
Google Scholar. Okay. All right.
Yes.
I'll keep that in mind. Thank you so much, as always.
Of course.
Alhamdulillah. So it's, Camila, read that comment. I need to clear my board here.
It is Camila's comment on having a financial plan makes me realize that I have no expert knowledge of crypto, NFTs, etc., but I have something Allah has prepared Bilalians with. I can recognize lies and corruption, so I listen to the YouTube advisors and let Allah lead my decision. Today, I have not lost. Thank goodness.
Allahu Akbar. You're smart. you are blessed. Praise be to Allah. Alhamdulillah. All right. Yeah, you talk about some things that no longer around. All right. Any last words, my dear? We going to sign off.
Let's get into the space. Let's get into the creative space. And like this last comment, you know, Allah will inspire those that are seeking to do good with what the resources that we have access to. But we have to commit to the process and be excellent listeners. Ask Allah for the insight and the understanding, because there's no reason why we should not be getting a piece of the wealth that is being generated, because it is absolutely our responsibility to engage and establish community. And that is the way that we'll be able to do it, by building wealth.
Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar.
Looking forward to hugging and kissing you soon. Tell Aisha, you know, I am so proud of her. Y'all keep it pushing. Keep it pushing. Teamwork make the dream work. Make it happen. All right, everybody. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.